Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, along with Chief Political Correspondent Steve Mistler and State House Correspondent Mal Leary. We're ready to catch you up on what's been happening, though it has been a quieter summer than some in the recent past. But we're going to start by jumping ahead to next year, when one of the marquee races on Maine's ballot will be the U.S. Senate seat, now held by Republican Susan Collins. Steve Mistler, the votes are not going to be cast for another 14 months. Collins hasn't even yet said if she'll run again, but none of that has stopped the early political advertising, has it?
No, it hasn't. I mean, it really started in early August, and we've seen a steady stream of efforts through paid advertising, social media influencing, and even just pressure on the press to do the dirty work of the campaigns. There's a dark money group called Maine Momentum, or 16 counties, that's running roughly about $1 million in ads, and that may be increasing as we speak, that are running all the way through the end of the year and will probably continue after that, that are essentially trying to sandblast Senator Collins, her reputation as a moderate or a centrist, really taking her to task on the Republican tax vote from 2017. And they haven't even really touched the big issue yet, which is her vote for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. But that will come, I'm sure of it. And on the other side, on the pro-Collins side, we've just recently saw a big ad buy from a super PAC. The big donor is a gentleman named Steve Schwartzman, who leads a private equity firm called the Blackstone Group. And they're really running a bunch of ads, sort of reaffirming Collins's reputation as a moderate and a centrist. So the ad wars have already started. The campaigns and the influencing are going on behind the scenes, and some of that has come into public view. And it's just really the beginning. This is going to be a very bitter and probably aggressive campaign. And a lot of the reason for that is that, 2020 is definitely a presidential election, but there are also 35 U.S. Senate seats on the ballot next year. And the GOP is defending 23 of those, and most are in red states. But they'll have a real fight on their hands in a few of the states, including Colorado, Georgia, and of course, Maine.
And you can add North Carolina to that list from what I saw this morning.
That's right.
Mal, assuming Collins does run again, it seems, at least to this newsman, that her fortunes may very well wind up being tied to President Trump's. How is she handling that?
Well, it could be, but I would not say it necessarily will be. And that's because if you look, she has managed in the past to chart this path on her reelection that is aimed at getting what I call the swing voters, the voters kind of in the middle, who can be persuaded. You're right to say there's some connection there, but I think you're going to see that a lot of people may vote for her who will not vote for Donald Trump, despite the efforts by the Democratic Party to try to tie the two together. Mainers are kind of independent in the way they vote, and I don't suspect this election is going to be that much different.
Yeah, I would just add to that, Erwin, that I think she is trying to walk a fine line here. This particular president, I would argue, is a lot different than some of the other ones that she may not have agreed with. I mean, for example, in 2016, she effectively declared President Trump to be unworthy of the office. And that, in an op-ed in the Washington Post in August before the election of that year. And I think that op-ed is going to follow her. You know, it's going to be brought up all the time. And she's going to have to try to reconcile whether or not she's supportive of the president on particular initiatives or the controversy of the day. I mean, right now, there's the president is embroiled in another controversy involving a whistleblower and a call to a foreign leader. I mean, that's another issue that could blow up, and that would, force a lot of people to find out where Senator Collins stands. And I just think that steady stream of chaos and his conduct is going to really put her in a tough spot. And we'll see how that shakes out down the road. I think, she has been in office for a very long time, and voters have rewarded her for her independence on a lot of issues. And so it'll be a real test to see if that'll endure the Trump presidency, too.
And we've got to remember, Erwin, we're still very early in this process. I think it's possible we're going to see a Trump supporter come out as a opponent to her in the primary, which changes the whole dynamic. Actually, might help her if she can defeat a Trump-supported candidate in the primary. So all of this stuff we're seeing so early in the campaign process that it's just amazing that we're talking about it this soon, when we don't even know who all the candidates will be until we're getting into the actual 2020.
I keep thinking of this scenario too next year, where let's say that Maine is in play for the presidential election because of the way we distribute our electoral votes, and the president comes here for a rally, for example, right? As he did, what, four times in 2016? What does Senator Collins do with that, I wonder? A scenario where the president comes here, and does she participate in that? Is she, you know, in Congress at that time? Is she unavailable? I mean, these are just sort of these scenarios that I'm just waiting to see. And of course, it's a little bit early to see how they play out, but I do think about them quite a bit.
We're going to keep focusing early on this race. There are three Democrats currently running for the seat. Bree Kidman, an attorney from Saco, longtime lobbyist Betsy Sweet, and Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon. Any early read on that side of the race?
Sarah Gideon is taking a different tack from some of the other candidates, Betsy Sweet in particular, who I think Betsy has been, I guess, more present, more out there, and I think by necessity, frankly, because she's effectively been boxed out by national Democrats and their aligned interest groups by declaring their support for Gideon so early. So Betsy's really had to try to get out there and do a lot of these sort of meeting with voters, these sort of mini town halls, whereas Gideon has really been, I don't want to say underground, but she certainly has not been as present as Betsy Sweet has. And that also follows a national trend where a lot of Democratic senatorial candidates are taking a similar route, where they basically focus on fundraising, they, you know, meet with their strategists and operatives, and really sort of limit their exposure and gaffes and mistakes that could, you know, really, you know, deep six a campaign pretty early. I think that's what she's trying to do. But of course, the Republicans, I noticed this yesterday, are coax her out of hiding. You know, they're on Twitter. They're saying, where is Sarah Gideon? Where is she? And as if it's a mystery to them. I mean, I think they understand what she's doing. They're just trying to, you know, draw attention to the fact that she is being relatively low key at this point.
And she's really following the advice of a lot of Washington advisors. And that's led some of the progressive Democrats, some of the folks supporting Betsy Sweet, to start calling her the Hillary candidate behind the scenes, because she's so structured in what she does. She's not granted interviews on any of the issues that we normally would be having stories about. She just, you can't reach her. She's not available. So that's going to come back and haunt her, as is, you know, Bree Kidman is not very well known, but he is making the rounds of Democratic Party groups. So if we're seeing this sort of break off from the far left already, we're looking at a very difficult Democratic primary situation, which they really don't need if they're going to defeat the incumbent in this race, because Susan Collins is still popular despite her slip in some of the polls.
Then there's the second congressional district, where the incumbent Democrat, Jared Golden, is seeking a second term. Now, Trump won the second district in 2016, but then Golden defeated incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin just 2 years later. What does that tell us, if anything, about the prospects for the GOP next year?
Republicans should feel like they have an opportunity in the second congressional district. It's a district that President Trump carried. And not only is it a swing district, but it typically incumbents like Golden are most vulnerable when they first run for re-election, that very first time. After, if they can win a second time, then that power of incumbency tends to build and become this, you know, unstoppable force in most cases. But what the GOP seems to be lacking, at, you know, aside from the fact that Eric Brakey has gotten into the race, is a candidate they can all get behind. It seems to me that we continue to hear rumblings about another Republican candidate getting into the race, a Republican candidate who's more aligned with former Governor Paul LePage, who, despite the fact he doesn't live in Maine, still has heavy influence over the party, at least among some of the activists there, which is why we're hearing that Adrian Bennett, his former spokesperson, may be running for that seat and probably will. And so there will be a primary in that contest. And And so we'll just see who will win out over, you know. I mean, Eric Brakey is a kind of a unique candidate. He's, you know, occupied the libertarian wing of the party for a long time. He was, you know, he served two terms in the legislature, you know, unsuccessfully ran for the U.S. Senate last year against Angus King, you know, did okay in that contest, but still lost by, you know, nearly 20 points. It is a real pickup opportunity for the GOP there. It seems to me like they're still fishing for a candidate.
And I suspect we may see more than just two-way race that's shaping up now, because, again, we're talking really early in the whole process here. And I can't believe there aren't some other Republicans out there thinking, well, maybe this is the time to get in. Maybe Jared Golden is vulnerable. I mean, the reality is Bruce Poliquin won more votes the first round. And the reason that that Jared got the seat was because of ranked choice voting. Well, what's the dynamic going to be next year? We have no idea. There may be two, three, four independents, or there may be none. And if it's a head-to-head between the parties in the second congressional district, that's going to be a real tough race.
All right, let's come back to this year, where the legislature met for 6 months, but left without a bond package. That prompted Governor Mills to call them back for a one-day session in late August, and Mal, bipartisanship seemed to break down at that session. Why was that?
Well, I think what we had was during the regular session, it was clear from talking to Republican leaders, they were not going to let a government shutdown occur, just off the table. So they were really forcing themselves into a compromise to pass the budget, which was the big item of concern. And a budget was passed. But immediately, when they started bringing up bonds, we saw the bonds fail first in the regular session before they failed in the special session. The only one going to the voters is the one dealing with transportation. And in this special session, the Republican leaders were making it very clear they are going to wield what power they have as the minority, and that comes to those items that need two-thirds vote. In the case of a bond issue, it's two-thirds of those present in voting. In the case of maybe a supplemental budget that the governor proposes in January, it will be two-thirds of those elected. Both are high hurdles, and they're supposed to be. That's why they were put in the Constitution. And I think that what we're seeing is the Republicans are going to say, we cooperated where we needed to cooperate, and that was passing a budget to run government. But now, folks, we're in a battle. Most foremost in many of their minds is out recruiting candidates now. They're out training candidates now, both in the House and Senate. They really want to recapture the legislature, and those sort of efforts are going to lead to less bipartisanship than we actually saw in this past session.
Yeah,
regular session.
Yeah, and I would add to that just that it was interesting because I think, you know, judging by the news conference that the governor had, in which she was visibly and noticeably livid at what happened, even though she didn't really secure any of the agreements that typically happen before there's a bond, you know, a special session is called and then there's a vote on a bond package, for example. Usually you get these agreements like laid out so that, you know, you don't call them in and then have your proposals get torpedoed. But she was very, very angry, and it didn't strike me as performative either during that press conference. So, you know, I think the Republicans, they used what influence and leverage they had in that, which was really about transportation, because if they didn't get an agreement on transportation, you know, that was going to sink half of the main Department of Transportation's capital improvement plan for next year. And they knew that. And so they, you know, used the leverage they had to get the bond package they want, and they just punted on the rest. As Mal pointed out, I mean, that's where their power is. It's very limited, but they have power on supermajority votes. And so therefore, they took what they wanted and left everything else on the table and left Governor Mills really beside herself as a result.
I mean, it certainly was an outcome that could have been foreshadowed, too, though. Couldn't it have been after June? I mean, the Republicans were sending a pretty clear message, even back in June,
oh, yeah,
that transportation was all they were going to approve.
they weren't hiding or, you know, being obtuse in their position here. They were pretty clear from the get-go what they wanted, and that was a transportation bond. That's what they got. And that's why it was a bit surprising to even call them in for the other three proposals. I mean, from Mill's perspective, she had given what she thought was a good compromise. But from their perspective, it wasn't enough. They were done compromising. They had passed the budget, as Mal pointed out. They wanted a transportation bond. Their allies are in that industry. That's what they got.
Well, finally, it looks like we're going to have a people's veto referendum fight over the new vaccination law. Mal, why don't you start us off by reminding us how that statute would change things?
The way it would change things, and it wouldn't take effect till 2021, is currently we have one of the pretty wide open vaccination laws. If you personally object to your child being vaccinated, that's a legitimate reason for the person, for the child not to be vaccinated. Medical reason, religious reasons. These votes were passed by one or two or three vote margins. This was a very close issue among legislators. And regardless of what anyone thinks about the legislature, they do, in my estimation, reflect pretty much the people of Maine. And I think that's what's going to happen on this people's veto. There's going to be a real question because they're taking away the religious exemption and they're taking away the personal exemption, only leaving the medical exemption. And that is being done by advocates because they say if you have a child who's not been vaccinated for some disease, goes into a classroom with a disease and gives it to all these other kids, that becomes a public health issue and the state needs to look at it. And we've seen this happen in other states. So politically speaking, it's interesting that out of all of the people's vetoes that were being circulated, this is the only one that got enough signatures, apparently, to qualify as an issue to go on the ballot. What's also interesting politically is it will go on the presidential primary ballot in March because of the wording in the Constitution, which says the next statewide general election. So there's a whole bunch of things swirling around on this. And I suspect if we talk about nasty elections and hard-fought things, this is going to be as much as any of the campaigns because the folks on both sides are very, very passionate about their cause. If you recall, Erwin, the public hearing on this went to 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm. Yeah, and to Mal's point, too, about how visceral the campaign this could end up being. I mean, in California, they're debating. California rolled back personal and religious exemptions several years ago, and now they're actually taking a closer look at scrutinizing medical exemptions. And as a result of that, the politics have just gotten really nasty out there. And this is not even a ballot campaign. This is a bill in the legislature that was just signed by the governor. There was an instance where, you know, an activist, a vaccine opponent, dumped what appeared to be blood on a state senator there, for crying out loud. I mean, I'm not saying that that's going to necessarily happen here, but you do have a fundamental question of, you know, personal liberty, I think, is at the heart of this. And that, I think, is what the vaccination opponents are going to utilize as this campaign proceeds, if it in fact does make the ballot. What will be interesting is whether making the ballot even matters, as Mal points out, because this will potentially be on the March 3rd ballot. At that time, that's a Democratic presidential primary. So you're going to have turning out effectively, I would assume, are Democratic voters. But then again, you know, vaccines also split Democratic voters, too. I mean, there's a lot of liberals that are opponents of vaccines. And so it's not a slam dunk that because it appears on March 3rd, that it will be defeated.
Yeah, you could end up with the vaccination referendum driving the turnout in the primary.
Exactly.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We're back on our regular schedule now, so you can download new versions of The Pulse each Friday afternoon at 3. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz.